So welcome back to everybody, and to anyone who's new, welcome. This is our last class in the series, and today we're going to be delving into a bunch of laws, actually a couple of laws, where Torah law and punishment seems, at least to the modern reader, to be overly harsh, where sometimes the punishment doesn't seem to be proportionate to the crime. And one might even say that this is a case of what we might call cruel and unusual punishment. We're going to be spending most of the class on the laws of assault and battery, and specifically the accompanying punishment of ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, yad tachat yad, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and a hand for a hand, which according to the simple sense of the verses would seem to be mandating that we have to literally give an eye for an eye. If an assailant takes out the eye of a victim, his punishment is that his actual eye is removed in return. After that, in less depth and depending on time, we're going to be looking at a second similar case, the laws of the rebellious son of a ben sorer umoreh, in which case a person, a son, a child, due to his rebellious nature and or due to his gluttony, Torah mandates that his parents bring him to the judges of the time to be stoned to death. And we listen to both of these cases and the laws and the punishment, and many of us are somewhat uncomfortable thinking, but isn't that so disproportionate to the crime? In the case of a rebellious son, wouldn't every single teenager then be stoned? If just because you're rebellious and you are, you know, chutzpahdik or whatever, does every son going to get stoned? And so we wonder how we're supposed to understand and justify the seemingly disproportionate nature of the punishments for these crimes. The two sets of laws, though, also raise another issue, an issue which actually comes up throughout the study of Tanakh, and that is the intersection between pshat, the simple sense of the text, and drash, the rabbinic interpretation of the text. In many cases, ours included, one reads the rabbinic interpretation of the verses, and it seems that they're not in accord with the simple sense of the verses. So, for example, in our case, the vast majority of rabbinic sages say that an ayin tachat ayin punishment is not literal, but rather refers to monetary compensation. In the case of the rebellious son, the sages add numerous restrictions and conditions that are not explicitly mentioned anywhere in the text. And one wonders, how are we supposed to understand this? How are we supposed to reconcile the two seemingly very different understandings of a verse? Are we to assume that when the sages give their interpretation, they're basing this on an oral tradition that really might have no match in the text? Or is it possible that really they're actively working with the text, just in ways that might initially, at least, elude the reader at first glance? So let's start with our first case, the laws of battery and assault and the punishment of ayin tachat ayin, of an eye for an eye. When one is trying to figure out what's an appropriate punishment for a crime, penal codes throughout the centuries have had to weigh and balance between competing objectives. Retribution, am I punishing in order to punish? Restitution, is punishment mainly for compensating the victim? Rehabilitation, am I trying to change the perpetrator so that he learns from his mistakes through his punishment? And finally, deterrence. Is the main goal of punishment to prevent such actions from happening in the future? So in the case of assault, if someone goes and knocks out somebody else's eye, what is the best, most just form of punishment? On one hand, someone might say that if we knock out the perpetrator's eye, well, that will probably be the best deterrent for him not to do it ever again. At the same time, it gives little practical benefit to the victim. On the other hand, if we give this person a monetary fine, yes, it will definitely compensate the victim, but there's no way nearly the same sense of just deserts as if you had taken out his eye. it's possible that in perhaps a different world, had we been able to, the closest approximation of justice would be to take out the perpetrator's eye and transplant it into the eye of the victim. As far as I know, that is not yet a scientific possibility. And so we have to question, so what could be second best? What is the closest approximation of justice that we have? So let's start with the psukim inside. The first place that the laws of assault and the punishment of an eye for an eye, taking an eye for eye, comes up is in Shmot Perek Chaf Aleph. And let me share the screen so we can see the verses inside. So in Shmot Chaf Aleph, in the context, one second, let me just clear this so people can see. Okay. In the context of a case where a bystander is actually hurt in a brawl between two men, we're told, if something happens to the bystander and that person is killed, v'natata nefesh tachat nefesh, this is at least one way of explaining the verse, then you should give a life for life. If no one was killed, but instead there was some harm to a limb, then you have to give ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, yad tachat yad, regal tachat regal, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, kviya tachat kviya, a burning for a burning, a wound for a wound, etc. In very similar language, we see the same set of laws in Sefer Vayikra, Perek Chaf Dalet. So let me just show you that. Here we're told, v'ish ki tein mum ba'amito, if anyone injures his neighbor, kasher asat kein yaselo, as he did, so shall it be done to him. Here explicitly, the verse is giving us an introduction that this punishment is measure for measure, like you did to the person, so should be done to you. And then again, it gives that very similar list. Shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, a fracture for a fracture, an eye for an eye, shein tachat shein, etc. Kashir yitein mum ba'adam, kin yinatin bo. As you injured someone, so shall it be done to you. The unit ends, umakeh behema yishamena, umakeh adam yumat. If someone smites an animal, they should pay. This sounds like it's probably monetary compensation, or at least an animal for an animal, but not an animal, not killing an animal instead of an animal. Umakeh adam yumat, but someone who kills a man should be killed. So in both Vayikra Chaf Dalet and in the psukim that we saw in Shmot, it seems that Torah is favoring retribution over compensation. The punishment for someone who maims another is that that person should be maimed. And that would seem to be the simple sense of the verse. It's important to note, though, that this isn't the only place where Tanakh talks about the punishment for maiming and for assault and battery. And really, just a few psukim before what we read earlier in Perek Chaf Aleph, we have a slightly different set of laws. So in verse 18, we're told, "Bechi yivun anashim, if men quarrel and one strikes another with a stone or with his fist, v'kai shagreo be'evan or be'gro, below your mood, and the person isn't killed, but rather he gets sick or he's confined to his bed. Im yakum v'galech b'chutz amishan, so if after a few days he walks around and he's healed, v'nika ha-makeh rak shifto yitin v'rapo yirapay." Okay, so the perpetrator has to go and pay for the loss of his time, meaning if he wasn't able to go to work for a certain amount of time, he should pay for that. V'rapo yirapay, and he has to pay for his healing, he has to pay for his medical expense. Here, in a case of assault, we have a very different law. Here, Torah allows for monetary compensation and mandates that, in this case, one has to pay both Shevet and Mipoy, we have to pay for the time that the person wasn't able to work and for his medical expense. Okay? There's one other verse that I want to look at, which a bunch of the commentators are going to note, and that's a verse in chapter 35 of Sefer Bamidbar, Perek Lamed Hei in Bimbar. The context of this verse is the laws of someone killing somebody else. And we're told that if there are witnesses, killing another is a capital crime and that person should be put to death. And then they elucidate, the lo tikhu kofer the nefesh roteach, asher hu rasha lamut, kimot yumat. You're not allowed to take a ransom for the life of a murderer who's guilty of death, but rather you have to put him to death. So here it tells us that if someone is punished with death, you're not allowed to replace that punishment by giving a ransom. The person's not allowed to offer monetary, you know, a certain amount of monetary value instead of being killed. But the fact that the pasuk goes out of its way to tell us that suggests to some, at least, that maybe specifically for a murderer, the verse is suggesting that you're not allowed to pay a ransom instead, but that in other cases, perhaps in cases of maiming or an assault, one would have been able to replace a bodily punishment with perhaps monetary compensation. So what we have by looking at our various verses is we have one set of verses which seems to mandate literal bodily harm, an eye for an eye, both in Parakhav Aleph in Sefer Shmot and in Sefer Vayikra. But alongside that, we have other verses which suggest that, at least in certain cases, Torah mandates money, that one has to go and pay some type of a financial fine for me. So one question that anyone's going to have to deal with in understanding our verses is, of course, how do we reconcile those two different verses, you know, sets of verses? Are they talking about different cases? Are they somehow supposed to work together? What's the balance between them, et cetera? And in addition, of course, our starting question of those verses that do mandate an eye for an eye punishment, how is that justified? How is that proportionate to the crime? Is that not cruel and unusual? So let's start with an approach to our sets of verses, which actually read the verses according to their literal sets. Within Chazal, this is the exceptional read, but there are several earlier commentators, including Philo and Josephus, so people living in the period of the second Beit Mikdash, not necessarily what you would call a traditional commentator, but nonetheless, their explanations of the verse might reflect the way that the verse was read and understood by lay people, at least, in their time. And one will get at least their understanding of why they think that the literal read is actually the most just read of punishment. So let's take a look inside. I'm going to share my screen. So Philo, again, living in the first century during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, tells us, our law, being the interpreter and teacher of equality, commands that offenders should undergo a punishment similar to the offense which they have committed. That, for instance, they should suffer punishment in their property if they've injured their neighbor in their property, in their persons if they've injured him in his body, or in his limbs, or in his organs, etc. If their evil designs have extended to his life, then the law commands that the punishment should affect the life of the malefactor. For to exact a different and wholly unequal punishment, which has no connection with or resemblance to the offense, but which is wholly at variance with it in all its characteristics, is the conduct of those who violate the laws rather than those who establish them. So according to Philo, the most just punishment is actually a punishment which gives you measure for measure punishment, a punishment in which there's similarity between the punishment and the crime that was committed. Okay, I'm going to go back to him in a second and elaborate. I just want to point out that there's one, as far as I know, only one rabbinic figure who also takes this approach, and that is Rabbi Eliezer. So in the Mechilta, Rabbi Eliezer says, "Ayin tachad ayin, shomei ani bein mitkaven bein sheino mitkaven, ino mishalim ela mamon." So he questions, does this mean, like the rest of the sages suggest, that whether intentional or unintentional, when someone maims another, that he must pay a monetary fine? And he answers no. Harei hakatuv motzi hamitkaven la'asot bo mum sheino mishalem ela mamash. And he says no. The text differentiates between an intentional person who acts intentionally and a person who doesn't act intentionally, and says that a person who acts intentionally has to pay mamash. He has to pay an actual limb. So Rabbi Eliezer is known for being a commentator who actually reads, I don't know if you call him a commentator, sage, whatever, who reads the psukim often according to their literal sense. So it's not so surprising that here too, he's going to say, why the rest of you sages taking this out of its literal sense? We should understand it literally, exactly as written. Okay, so both Philo and Josephus also, which we didn't read, and Rabbi Eliezer, all suggest that the simple reading of the text is the way we're supposed to read the text. And they say, don't think that this is unjust. In fact, Philo tells us, how could you expect punishment that doesn't fit the crime to be just? And the truth is, if we think about punishment throughout Tanakh, that concept of midah keneged midah, punishment that is measure for measure, comes up all over the place. For example, the Meraglim, the spies, are punished that, or not the spies themselves, but Am Yisrael, are punished that they have to wander in the desert for 40 years. Why 40? Because they had spied out the land for 40 days. 40 is going to match 40. David HaMelech, after he commits adultery with Bathsheba, is told that part of his punishment is going to be that you slept with somebody else. Other people are going to sleep with your wives. Similarly, he kills Uriah with a sword, and Hashem tells him, sword is not going to veer from your family. In all these cases, the Torah mandates, or Tanakh is mandating, a measure for measure punishment. And though some of us might think that it's cruel, the people who take this approach suggest, just like you don't necessarily think midah keneged midah punishment is cruel in other areas, you shouldn't think that it's cruel in this area. Why should the perpetrator be better off than his victim? That wouldn't be fair. In addition, they say, if you're looking at law's purpose as being one of deterrence, this is the best deterrent for someone not to do the crime again. If you cut off someone's hand or you cut off someone's leg after they had done something similar, there's a really good chance that people around will be less likely to do so in the future. Third, they say, this type of a law is an equalizer. What do I mean by that? There's no difference between rich and poor. If a punishment had been monetary in nature, and that what one was looking for was monetary compensation, in such a case, the rich person, for whom money is no big deal, he's not really getting very punished, right? Because for him, to go and pay X amount of money meant nothing. Whereas for a poor person, that same monetary compensation would be a big deal. But anybody who loses their foot or their hands or their eye, et cetera, is going to be feeling equally punished. So conceptually,
the solution there is just make the rich person pay a lot more than you would make a poor person. I mean, if $1,000 fine is a big deal to me, a $10,000 fine might be something, you know, significant to a rich person.
Okay, so that might be one way of dealing with that problem, for sure. One could say that, and one could say that when we're setting a price on what this loss meant, we're not just saying what did this loss mean for the person who's receiving it, but what will it mean for the person who did? I think in general, when people think about though how they're going to, you know, set a price, since they're giving it to the victim, they tend to think about, what does the victim need to feel whole again? In which case, then, it would be the same thing no matter who the assailant is. But you're suggesting, no, a different way of dealing with this is to go and work out, based on the assailant's own wealth, okay, what would be that amount of punishment for him? What would be the equivalent? Definitely fair. Okay, so these people obviously are on the other side, so they're not thinking those terms. Yeah, Dahlia.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, an eye is not the same for an artist or maybe a wagon driver who needs to see out of both eyes or someone else as it is for some rich man who has everybody doing everything for him. So, you know, and a hand for a laborer is his whole way, is his whole parnassa. He can't even support his family anymore if he loses his hand. So, whereas a hand for someone else may not be the way he makes his living.
Okay, and so good. So good. When we get to, in a minute, when we turn to the sages' reading of the story of our halacha, so they're going to be taking into account some of the things that you just said, arguing against this literal approach, where the literal approach is trying to suggest that this is the most fair reading, when we saw that you can make a similar types of cases for monetary compensation, and the same problems that exist would exist for bodily compensation, because no, an eye isn't worth the same thing to everybody. A hand isn't worth the same thing. Someone who's a pianist, obviously their hands are going to be different than someone who doesn't use their hands every day, etc. 100%. One last thing, as far as this approach, like we started with, we said that we have sets of verses that seem to be pointing in the direction of retributive punishment of an eye for an eye, but we also have these other verses which talk about compensation. So how would this approach, which suggests that one is supposed to pay an eye for an eye, deal with those other verses that talk about paying compensation for lost wages and for medical expenses, et cetera? So I think there's probably two different ways that they could potentially deal with those verses. One might be to say that we're talking about different cases. When do you pay an eye for an eye? Only if we're talking about a permanent injury, meaning if I knocked out someone's eye and there's no way they could get it back, I did some type of a burn that is a permanent injury, then I pay an eye for an eye, a burn for a burn. But the verses in the earlier part of the parak, which we're talking about a monetary fine, were referring to something that was not permanent. And therefore, it wouldn't be fair to give an eye for an eye because we weren't talking about something permanent. We were talking about something that was going to be healed. And therefore, in that type of a case, we don't do bodily harm. Instead, we use a monetary fine. Right? So these commentators make a case for justice in literal, by what we might call tally, an eye for an eye punishment, saying that really, on one level, there's a lot of logic in here. It's a great deterrent. It's a case where there's no reason to say that the perpetrator should be better off than his victim. And that measure for measure punishment, we all agree, is something that Tanakh does elsewhere, because we all see that there's some justice in the idea that the punishment should somehow be similar to the crime. Nonetheless, not surprisingly, the vast majority of sages are quite uncomfortable with this concept of literal eye for an eye punishment, which leads them to suggest that the verses aren't talking about that at all, but rather they're talking about monetary compensation. And what the commentators need to do, of course, is one, they explain conceptually why they think that monetary payment is the more just form of payment. In addition, though, and this is probably the harder part, they have to explain the text. Because if you're going to take the text out of its simple sense, you have to explain when it says that just as you did to him shall be done to you. Well, what do you mean by that if you're not giving literal punishment? If the pasuk says eye for an eye, well, how are you reading? So what we're going to see is several different sources, each of which will do a combination of explaining conceptually why they think this is correct and give some textual proofs, either explaining away what's difficult or trying to use textual proofs to show how their reading is actually the simple sense of the verses, and that they're not taking the verses out of context or rereading them. They're actually reading them the way they were supposed to be read, and that there's really no conflict between pshat and drash. So I'm going to share my screen, and we're going to start with the Mechalta. So the Mechalta starting point is just to tell us that this refers to money. Ayin tachat ayin mamon. Atah omer mamon, oh, I know, ela ayin mamash. So they question, are you referring to monetary compensation? Or maybe the pasuk is actually referring to a literal, actual eye. Hayah Rabbi Shmuel omer. So Rabbi Shmuel says, I can prove to you from the text in Parsha, in Sefer Vayikra, in Perikav Dalet there, that we're talking about monetary compensation. So how does he prove it? So if you remember, the last pasuk of that unit had said and made a comparison between smiting an animal and smiting a man, and said in the case of an animal, you pay. In the case of a man, you kill him. So the Mechelta Rabbi Shmuel tells us that the verse is making a comparison between the laws of animals and the laws of man. Just like the laws of animals are monetary in nature, that teaches us that we should reread the entire unit in light of the obvious payment of animals to be monetary, that all those laws referring to maiming humans were monetary in nature as well. So on one level, one might be swayed by this and say, yeah, in general, how do we know how to understand the verse? If I can take a clear cut verse and read then that back into all the other verses, well, then maybe that will be one way of understanding my In this case, it's a little bit more complex, I think. And I'm not so sure so many people would have come to Rabbi Ishmael's agreement on their own, because he says you're making a comparison between the laws of men and the laws of animals. How do you know in which direction it goes? He decided that we're going to take the laws of animals, which he says is clear cut, in order to understand the laws of men. But one could have done the exact opposite and said, when it says you should pay back the animal, what does it mean that you should pay back the animal? Well, take your literal eye for an eye, etc., and go back to the animal. So I think it's important to recognize that this isn't necessarily the simplest way of reading it. In addition, I think the simple sense of the verse is that it's actually drawing a contrast between animals and men, and that you would never think that it's trying to compare the two, that you should say that they're similar. The whole point is to say, well, I'm only making monetary compensation for an animal, and you don't have to kill the animal. When a person kills another person, you actually have to kill them. And everyone agrees that the killing is nefesh tachat nefesh, literal assault, a life for a life. Okay. So I personally do not find this textual proof to be extremely strong. Nonetheless, it is a starting point, and we'll see that other commentators point to other verses, which might be, I think, a bit stronger in their textual reading. The second source we're going to look at is really interesting. It's Ibn Ezra is bringing a conversation between Rav Sadia Gaon and a Karaite named Ben Zuta. And even though it's a slightly long one, actually read it inside, because he had each of them fighting for their side. So as many of you probably know, what do Karaites believe in, or more importantly, what don't Karaites believe in? Karaites reject the oral law. Okay? They don't accept Torah Shabbat Peh, and they read verses according to their simple sense. So obviously, when they read Ar Psukim, their natural tendency is to read this literally. This is an eye for an eye. And they're very upset at rabbinic interpretation because it seems to be coming from nowhere, right? So in some sense, rightfully so. It's a good question. Where do you get the idea that this is monetary compensation? So Ibn Ezra brings this entire conversation and back and forth between Rav Sadia Gaon and Ibn Ezra. And I'm going to share my screen so we can see it inside. So let me just, this might be the easiest way of reading it, because this should be side by side. Hold on. Let me just scroll down, sorry. Okay. Amar Rav Sadia, lo nuchal lefereish zot parsha kimashma. He says, we can't possibly, but he starts off on a conceptual proof. We can't possibly interpret this verse according to its plain meaning. Why not? Ki madam hika in chaviro, b'sara shlishit orino. Ech yitachem shi yuka maka kazot b'lito sefet u'migrat, ulay yashich orino kulo. He says, for practical purposes, there's no way that you could possibly implement an eye for an eye fairly. Because if you hit someone else's eye and you make them go partially blind, right? They lose, let's say, a third of their eyesight. How in the world are you going to be able to go and punish the perpetrator that he loses a third of his eyesight? That would be impossible, right? There's no way that you could measure the exact, right? You know, so same thing with a burn, right? Someone gave someone else a secondary burn. How am I going to ensure that I give the perpetrator also a second degree burn instead of a first degree burn or a third degree burn? Okay. So that's his first argument. Okay. And he says, and in cases of burning, you might even come to kill the person by accident. So Ben Zuta replies, "Halo katub b'makom acher, kasher yitemum ba'adam, kini natimo." So Ben Zuta says, well, how are you going to explain the simple sense of the verse? Verse 20 in Sefer Vayikra tells us quite clearly that just as you maimed a man, so should it be done to you. So here, Rav Sadia Gaon says, we don't have to read the verses you do. Yesh l'zeh bet tachad al, v'nei tamo kin yinatin alav onesh. So Rav Sadia says, that word bow, which in the simple sense, or at least the way Ben Zuta was reading it, if I inflict a blemish on somebody else, I shall inflict a blemish in him, right? That bow means in him. And if you're going to say it means in him, well, then you mean a literal blemish in the person. Rav Sadia Gaon points out truthfully that not every place where you have that preposition bet does it mean in him. Sometimes it can mean upon. Okay. And that's, you know, we could probably find a bunch of examples in Tanakh where a bet and an al are interchanged. So one has the question, well, so how does that answer the problem? So he says, because if you had read it as yinatein alav, right? As you gave a blemish to a person, so should be placed upon him. If you have upon him instead of in him, then what does the verse really mean? As you blemish that person, so too a punishment should be placed upon you. And we're not dictating what type of punishment, because the punishment not in him, in his personal body, but rather upon him, I'm placing a punishment upon him. Okay, so that's how he takes care of one verse that might have been used by the other side as proof of literal Italian punishment. So Ben-Zuzza says, but I have another passage for you. Kasher asa kenya asala. He says, in this case, we have a verse that says, as was done to him, so too should be done back. I mean, as he did, sorry, so too should be done back to him. So here too, Rav Saadia says, look, this isn't the only place that we have similar language. When Shimshon is in Sefer Shoftim, there's a story where Shimshon's wife is given to others, and Shimshon then exacts revenge on the people by burning their fields. And when he burns their fields, he tells them, "Kasher asu li kein asiti lehem." As they did to me, so too I did to them. So very similar to our verse, as he does, so too shall be done to them. And Rav Saadia Gaon points out quite correctly, Shimshon didn't do exactly to them what they did to him. He gave them a punishment for what they did, but it wasn't the exact measure for measure of punishment. So he says, so too in our verse, you're reading this pasuk too literally, right? The same language is used elsewhere where it clearly doesn't mean literal measure for measure of punishment. So too by us, it just means you should give him an appropriate punishment for his crime. Then Zuzza then comes up and says, okay, so you took care of my textual issues. Let me raise a conceptual issue. Im haya hamakeh ani, ma'ya unsho. He says, but if you're going to talk about monetary compensation, well, what happens if the perpetrator, if this criminal that memed the other is poor? He's not going to be able to pay the fine, so he won't get punished at all. So Rav Saadia says, well, your argument can be made in the opposite direction as well. Im iver ya'aver ein pikeach. Well, what happens if a blind person goes and blinds another? He too won't be losing out on anything if he gets punished because he's already blind. And he says, and not only that, at least the person who's poor, at some future point, he might make enough money to be able to pay it back. Someone who's blind is never come to see again to be able to be punished by being smitten with blind. And then Rav Saadia ends with, I think, an important point. Haklal lo muchal lefaresh al torah pirush shalem im lo nismach al torah shebal peh. So even though Rav Saadia gives a whole bunch of conceptual proofs, tries to reread the text so we understand how his reading is not going against the text, at the end of the day, though, he says, we can't explain Torah Shebichtav unless we rely on Torah Shebaal Peh. Just like we got Torah Shebichtav, so too we receive Torah Shebaal Peh. Ein hefresh b'neim, there's no differentiation between the two. One other thing, though, that Rav Saadia does have to answer, and that is not just the psukim of Kasher Asa Keni Asa Lo, but perhaps more importantly, how do you understand the words Ayin Tachat Ayin themselves? Right? Why, if Tanakh really wanted to tell us that this was monetary compensation, did they word it in a way that suggests that it's an eye for an eye? And so he says, Ru'ui liyot eino tachat eino. He says, because what the text wanted to share was that you really deserve to have your eye taken out for this. Meaning, Tanakh is trying to tell you that even though we're giving you monetary compensation, you should recognize the severity of your crime. You should recognize that really when you compensate the person, you should be trying to compensate them so that they become whole again, as if you gave them back their eye. And so you really have to give enough money that will compensate for that lost eye. Okay. So that's Rav Saadia. And again, you could see how each of these commentators is saying conceptually why they think that it has to be monetary compensation and struggling to deal with the text itself. I'm going to give one last person who does similarly, and that's Rav Yosef Bachor Shor. So in explaining the text, Rav Yosef Bachor Shor also starts with a conceptual issue, and he says, "Hapsuchim mochichin shehud meleg." Says the verses prove that we're speaking of monetary compensation, that when you give a regal for a regal, you're talking about money. "Shekshadam imitadam in the fayez b'mamon u'mishum hachin harak." He says, when you kill somebody, in that type of a case, there's no possibility for compensation because the victim is dead. And because of that, the perpetrator is killed. But someone who lost the limb. He says, what benefit whatsoever will be given to the victim if a blemish is given to his perpetrator? There's absolutely no point in that. It does not benefit the victim at all. And so, yes, in cases of injury to limbs, we are not talking about an eye for an eye literally, but rather a monetary compensation. Better that he should have some money to support himself. And he adds, as we see with those other verses in the same parak in Sefer Shmot, parak Chav Aleph, that when you go and maim or wound another, they don't tell you there that you should go and give him a similar wound, but rather, Rav Yosef Bechor Shor here suggests that I should learn from one pasuk to another. Which pasuk should I learn from? I should learn from that pasuk that talks about paying monetary compensation for medical expenses and for loss of work, to recognize that that concept of medical compensation, monetary compensation goes through all these verses, and to read it into our verses of an eye for an eye as well. Okay? So that's a second approach, which suggests this is monetary compensation for many conceptual reasons to make it an appropriate punishment, because I can't actually physically give an eye for an eye punishment that's fair because I can't measure the amount of eyesight lost, etc. Because it's good for the victim, who won't gain anything by the fact that my perpetrator is losing a limb, but will gain something if he's compensated. Okay. And in addition, trying to work with the text itself to explain away the verses that seem to be indicating measure for measure punch. Nonetheless, some people are still a little uncomfortable with this because they say some of those readings were forced. Not every one of those readings of those verses is the simplest reading of the verse. And so there's a third approach that tries to chart a middle ground between these two ideas of monetary compensation versus retributive eye for an eye, literal eye for an eye punishment. And these people suggest that maybe there's a dual track system. What do I mean by that? Maybe these laws are supposed to be working on two levels, both addressing the need for tallying for measure punishment, and also the need for compensation at the same time. And this is taken by various people in slightly different ways. So let me show the screen and we'll see just a couple of insights. Okay. So Shadal suggests that maybe the idea of tallying versus monetary compensation is on a case-by-case basis. What do we mean by that? He says, the psukim that we read in Sefer Bamidbar talk about that you're not allowed to take a ransom for a murderer, which might imply that in other cases, you would be able to take a ransom. In other words, that there are certain laws where, yes, the law stated in the text is, for example, literal eye for an eye punishment, but there's a choice to instead take a ransom and to pay monetary fines instead. So he says, and according to Shadal, in what type of a case would that be? So he says, the decision of whether one person should be have his eye gouged out or whether he should be compensated monetarily was actually left to the judges in every single case. So he suggests, if someone comes to the judge and the person is a really rich person who won't be at all bothered by having to give some type of a monetary fine, says in that type of a case, the judges might suggest you get literal eye for an eye punishment. But someone who money is still a deterrent, and for them it actually is a punishment, that person would have gotten a monetary fine. So Shadal suggests that actually the psukim are allowing for both readings simultaneously, saying that there's a place for eye for an eye punishment, but from what we learn in Midbar Lamed Hey, that there's this concept of taking a ransom for cases that are not cases of murder, we learn that there are other cases where monetary compensation is fine. Shadal's student, the Ha'al Moshe, suggests something that connects to what we were talking about last class. So if you remember last class, there were a few cases where the Ha'al Moshe suggests that maybe not all laws are equally binding or meant for all periods of history, and that there might be an evolving society which mandates different necessities for different times. So he suggests that's true in our case as well. That the punishment of an eye for an eye was very fitting for when Bnei Yisrael first left Mitzrayim. The Am Yisrael who first left Mitzrayim needed a harsh, harsh penal code because their ethical sense was very, very low, having been living in Egypt. And therefore, on their own, just by a normal ethical sense, they wouldn't have gotten to proper behavior. And so Torah mandated certain very harsh codes of law so that they would be deterred from doing certain things. Okay. But he says, we'll continue on. I'll read inside here. He says, V'razal hachu b'kvot ha-nevim v'ashotim shekadmum sheshinu ha-nimusim lefi tzoras manam. He says, but Chazal, learning from Nevi'im and Shoftim that came before them, knew that when the time was different and people no longer needed such a harsh penal code, that the halacha was read to be monetary compensation. Okay, so this is, again, quite radical, just like we saw last week, where someone is suggesting that not all of Torah's laws as read on their simple sense are eternal, and that some of them might have a dual meaning, one meaning for a certain time period, a separate meaning for a later time period when the people were ready for a different understanding. So he too, though, would be reading the verses similar to the way that everybody else who allowed for monetary compensation and suggest these verses have the ability to be read in two ways. One as literal eye for an eye, one as a metaphoric monetary compensation. And Chazal were given the ability, transmitted through generations or whatever, to say when society was in need of which type. So that's a second way of seeing a double track. One last, which also relates to what we were talking about last year and ideal versus reality, but to some extent, in the exact opposite direction that we saw last week, is Sforna. So Sforna says, Hayara oi kefi hadin hagamur, shehi midah keneged midah, uba kabbalah sheyishalei mamon mipnei chisaron hasharatino. Says, really, the ideal is what's written in Torah. Okay? So he says, the ideal would be true justice, like Philo said, and like Rabbi Eliezer said, is midah keneged midah, is measure for measure, little punishment. That would be the most just way of punishing. However, there are practical difficulties with it. Because you can't accurately measure how to apply the principle of an eye for an eye. And once you can't accurately measure it, well, then it's no longer the most just and fair form of punishment. And therefore, Chazal said, we have no choice but to use monetary compensation instead because the ideal can't be realized. And due to practical considerations, we need instead to use monetary compensation. Okay. So we've seen three very different approaches to our question. One school of thought, he says, measure for measure, literal punishment is the meaning of the text, and that is fair and just. That's the most appropriate form of punishment for a person. It deters them. It's a midah keneged midah, appropriate to match your punishment to your crime. It equalizes poor and wealthy, etc. Second approach, this is no. We're very uncomfortable with that. And he tries to suggest that the verses themselves can be read to mean monetary compensation, and pointing out that practically it would be very hard to do a fair eye for an eye, and suggesting that maybe that's too harsh, etc., and therefore rereading those texts. Third approach to suggest maybe the texts were meant to be read together, and that there's really a double track system here where there's aspects of both retribution and of monetary compensation, either depending on the person, and that was given into the hands of the courts to decide who gets which punishment, or for different time periods. One time period needed a certain type of a punishment, a different time period needed a different one, and again, that's given into the hands of Chazal to determine which one, or just practically, Torah setting out the ideal, but sometimes we just can't realize it, and when we can't realize it, we have to go to a different understanding. Questions until now? Okay, so we have about 15 minutes. And again, I told you I was going to do this not as in-depth, but I just wanted to see how similar issues come up in another set of verses. So again, let's start with the psukim themselves. the case of a rebellious son. So in Devarim Perikop Aleph, we're told about a certain child who is extremely stubborn and rebellious and doesn't obey his parents. And we're told if a person has a son like this, who doesn't listen to his mother and he doesn't listen to his father, and even though they rebuke him, he doesn't listen to them. Okay? So basically every single teenager. And his mother and his father take hold of him and they bring him to the kinim of the city, they bring him to the elders, and they tell the elders, our son is a rebellious child, he doesn't listen to us. And here they add in something that we hadn't seen until now. He's a glutton and he's a drunkard. And we're told, and what is the punishment? And you have to, that all the people of the city have to stone him and he will die. And you should burn out the evil from your midst. Okay. So here again, we have a case where there seems to be disproportionate punishment because this child is rebellious. He doesn't listen to his parents because he eats too much. He drinks too much. Therefore, you have to stone him. Okay? The verses that I think raise an important question just to understand the case itself. On one hand, the parents speak of his not listening to them. And on the other hand, they speak of his gluttony, of his drinking and his eating. And one has the question, are these two different conditions? Meaning this has to be a child who is both not listening to his parents, but also someone who eats too much and drinks too much? Or are we supposed to understand one in terms of the other? Is the gluttony just an example of his not listening to his parents? Or the opposite, is the gluttony the main problem? Okay. And what we meant by not listening to his parents is in the realm of gluttony. Okay. So it could be either you need both, the food and drink is the main problem, or the not listening to the parents is the main problem. And we see commentators that take each of those different approaches, but along the way, of course, trying to understand no matter which approach I take, how am I supposed to understand this law? Okay. So I'm going to not read so many things inside just for the interest of time, but I'm going to share the screen so you can see the sources, at least as we talk about them. And to show how so often commentators are somewhat consistent in the way that they look at things. Philo, like earlier, says, our law should be read according to literal exactly what you see is what you get. Unlike rabbinic sages, we're going to add in a lot of conditions, try to understand it to refer to something else. He says, this is about children who don't listen to their parents. And why do they deserve such a harsh punishment? So he says, because parents invest a ton in their children. Okay? Parents give them food, they give them an education, and they support them, etc. They brought them into the world. And because of that, he says, a parent is allowed to have supreme authority and control over their children, right? Where he's allowed to punish them in whatever way they want. And if they don't listen to his threats, they can inflict bodily harm on them. They can imprison them. And in certain cases like ours, they can even bring and put them to death. Okay. And he points out, this is something that's given to both the mother and father have to agree, because unless they both agree, then it means that the kid isn't at the stage where one can actually punish him by death. And this is the last line here, parents have received not only the power of a ruler and governor over their children, but also that of a master, according to both the very highest characteristics of the possession. So what Philo suggests is that in the time of Tanakh, parents had complete control and authority over their children. And to some extent, children were considered the possessions of their parents. And so a parent could do whatever they wanted to their child. And that he does not see this as unjust. If they go to a point where they're so rebellious, a parent, just like he could do whatever else he wants with his possessions, he could do this to his child and bring them to the courts. Okay? Most of us, I assume, find that a little harsh, and that wouldn't be the parenting that you would want to have with your children. But I think, again, it's important to recognize that what one generation finds unjust, somebody living in a different time period had absolutely no problem. Right? Philo thinks that this is a total fine way of dealing with your child. Yeah, Dive. You're on mute.
The problem is you don't know what the parent asked of the child that he's rebelling against. You don't know. Maybe he's telling him to be a criminal. Maybe he's telling him to do something cruel to another person. Maybe he's telling him to make a living in an unjust fashion. I don't know. Not every parent, parents are not all the same.
And this
paints all parents with this right, which is so ridiculous.
Okay, so you're raising a very important question, I think, that who can necessarily ensure that a parent is not abusing their power as a parent, and that this is, would be fair. And of course, that's one of the reasons that Chazal don't go in the direction of Philo and don't understand that halacha is in exactly the same way that Philo does. But again, the main reason I brought that is one, to see the consistency where he's reading, you know, lots of different stories where we're bothered by it. And he's like, no, that's just, right? Why are you trying to bother to take the text out of its simple sense or to read around it or insert things into the text? You can read it according to its simple sense. And again, suggesting that maybe at least in the time of Tanakh, the way that households were run might have been different than the way they are now, right?
That's not actually what I said. But I didn't say that the parent is abusing his power. I said the parent may be telling the child to do something that's against halacha. And there's nothing in here that tells you that it has to be what the parent is saying has to be just.
That's fair. Okay. So the truth is, I'm not sure what Philo would say. Philo might actually be saying that when he's saying that Tanakh is allowing for a father to go and punish their children this way for not listening to him, it's only in things that the court would have agreed was not problematic, and that's why they have to bring him to a court, right? The parent's not allowed to just go and punish the child on his own. They have to bring him to the elders. And Philo would probably say, again, I don't know, but I know for a fact that the elders are supposed to be that balanced to ensure that this is not because the father said to do something totally unreasonable or against halacha or something like that, for sure. Okay. We don't have so much time, so I'm just going to share quickly some of the approaches that Chazal and more traditional commentators take. So in contrast to Philo, who suggests that this whole story is about rebelliousness and about not listening to the parents, Chazal actually suggests that it's the solel, the solvay aspect, that gluttony aspect, which is the key problem here, that this child is someone who doesn't listen in the sense of his overeating and overdrinking. And they say that if your kid was asked to turn on the light and he didn't turn on the light, you're going to go and bring him to be killed? No, obviously not. That's not what we're talking about. Nonetheless, even you see that we're talking about gluttony, one has the question, why is that okay? And so the Gemara in Sanhedrin famously tells us, why is that okay? Nidon ashem sofo. Okay? Higia Torah l'sof da'ato shaben soer o'moreh, shesof migamer nechosei aviv u'mevakesh nido ve'ino mosev yotzei v'parashat trachim u'le'asim atabiyot. The Gemara says, we're actually not killing the person for what he's doing right now, for his gluttony right now, but the Torah knows that the mindset of this type of a child is that in the end, in his, basically, I guess the way that they'd be looking at this is, think about it as someone who's addicted, right? Someone who has an addiction to drink or to meat or to drugs, let's say, right? So what happens? In his addiction, in order to feed that addiction, he's going to squander his father's money, and then he's going to need more money, and he's going to go and rob, and with robbing, he's going to go and kill, etc. And therefore, we kill him now before he's able to bring evil on the rest of the world. Okay. Now, this, of course, answers one ethical question by raising it another. Can I kill someone for what they're going to do in the future? How do you know that the kid's not going to repent and change his ways in the middle? Right? What allows you to go and say, right now, you're bad enough, even though you haven't actually done anything wrong, that I'm going to go and prevent you from having the opportunity to change and kill you off now? Right? So Chizkuni answers this in a very interesting way. He says, think of this person as a rodef. Okay? A rodef is someone who is running after another to kill. And the law is that if you see someone about to kill someone else, you are allowed to come and kill them first. And they say, view the ben sower u'moreh, this rebellious son, as a rodef, as a pursuer. Okay? And the idea would be that because you know he's about to kill someone, even if about doesn't mean in the next minute, but rather in the future, you could kill him now. Of course, this still raises tons of questions. Because at what point does someone be considered a rodef? When I'm planning a terrorist attack, when I'm about to press the trigger, when I'm growing up and you see negative traits in me, right? Are those negative traits enough to say, oh, in the end, he's going to become like this? So what some people suggest is if you actually read the list of things that Chazal suggests are the conditions necessary in order to bring this boy to be brought and stoned as a Ben Sorer or Moreh, they add tons and tons of conditions. And some of those conditions have to do with how he stole from his parents, right? How he eats and how he drinks, with the suggestion being that if you were actually someone who fulfilled all of those criteria, then that's enough basis and evidence to suggest this person is far enough off the derech, that he's close enough to be considered being a Lodi, right? Still, for many, there's an ethical issue in the answer itself that might be equivalent to the ethical issue of the problem that we started, okay? I'm going to skip Ramban for interest of time and just look at one other Gemara, okay? The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that according to, again, some of the conditions that Chazal put on the case of the Ben Sorer Moreh, we're told, if the father and mother do not have, are not alike in their voice and in their appearance, etc., he doesn't become a Ben Sorer Moreh. Right? And then they bring a certain verse in order to prove where they get this idea that they have to be similar. He doesn't listen to our voice, therefore their voices have to be alike. Now, someone could say that this is metaphoric, and what are they saying? If the parents are not in agreement about how they view their son, then he can't be brought as a Ben Sorer Moreh. Other people say, no, we're talking about literally that they have to have a similar voice, and in which case, go to the bold, Ben Sorer Moreh lo haya v'lo atid l'hiyo. Really, Tanakh never, ever meant anyone to be brought and killed for being a rebellious son. Why was it written? Drosh v'kabel v'char. Just so that you can learn and get a reward. In other words, the entire case was never meant to be. And again, according to this, one of the reasons that Chazal adds so many conditions, the boy has to be a certain age and he has to eat in a certain place and he has to eat a certain type of food in a certain amount, et cetera, is to ensure that it will never be. Because Tanakh, according to them, never meant for it to be, but it did mean for us to read this. What does it mean for us to read this? And so Chazal explains that why would you bring a halacha that's never meant to be carried out? That's because sometimes you need to read it in order to be deterred from doing it, to recognize the seriousness of the nature of such an action, that a child and a family as a whole is supposed to read and say, if this is how your child is behaving, that is a red flag. Because Torah is telling you that on one level, this kid should have been deserving of death. Will we ever actually kill him for it? No. I don't want you to actually kill him, but I want you to be forewarned. I want you to recognize that this is a very serious, serious crime. And therefore, we're going to include it and write it in a really harsh way. And to some extent, that's the same way that Chazal were reading in Ayin Tacharayin. Why word it as an eye for an eye if you never meant for someone to actually literally take out their eye? Because you need to know the seriousness of the crime. You need to know that on one level, that was the appropriate punishment. So with that, our time's up. So I just wanted to thank everybody for joining for the series. I hope that everyone had a lot of food for thought and lots of questions. And I would love to continue the conversation with anybody that's interested. Please feel free to always be in contact. And in your decision, maybe to have another series sometime in the future. So whoever has any questions or thoughts, whatever, feel free to stay on.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting series.
Thank you.
Each one was just wonderful. You prepare so well and you deliver everything so beautifully and then navigate between everybody's comments and insights. Just keep teaching and let us know through any of the avenues, Torah in Motion or
Yeah, this was wonderful.
Wonderful.
It really was.
Thank you, everybody.
You're really a gifted, you're a gifted teacher.
Yes.
And you know, obviously this is your calling.
Yes.
We're fortunate enough to, I'm across the ocean and to be able to
yeah.
share Torah with you is just an unbelievable miracle of this day and age.
Right. So when you all visit Israel next time, welcome to come and visit in person.
Thank you. But you're teaching in so many places, right?
I teach in several seminaries, and not so much in adult education form. So, but Mamaja, whoever would love to continue learning, I would love to continue teaching. So,
definitely.
Thank you all for an amazing series.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.